Like to call the Mobile Source Committee meeting to order for May 24th and ask that all cell phones now be put away at this point. I would ask that Director Canepa lead us in the pledge.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
It's not a chant, it's a pledge.
You have to pronounce every word, Scott.
I know, but he's chanting. Making it like it's a cult. All right, roll call, please.
On the roll for the Mobile Source Committee meeting of May 24th, 2018, Director Abe Koga, Director Cutter, Director Groom.
Present.
Director Hudson. Director Ju, Director Kim.
Here.
Director Miley, Director Mitchoff.
Here.
Director Sparing, Committee Vice Chair Canepa.
Here and on.
Committee Chair Haggerty.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Oh. Do we have a quorum? Yes. Obviously, the one to right, my right has Tourette's. Can I get an approval of the minutes for April 26th?
This is Tourette's Syndrome Awareness Month, by the way, you know.
Well, that explains your
outbreak.
We did
a thing on Tuesday. You're not supposed to make fun of people.
Well, I'm not making fun of people. It's just you had an outburst. So can I get an approval of the minutes for April 26th? Thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Second by Canepa. Is there any objection to the motion? Motion passed without objection. Item 3.
Good morning, Chair Haggerty.
Are you sure?
Yes. Good morning, Chair Haggerty and members of the Mobile Source Committee. This morning, we're going to start with agenda item number 3, which is...
That's the one I asked for. Okay. I did say that.
Yes.
Are you okay, Damien? Are you trying to run the meeting over there?
No, we're good.
So item number 3, we're wrapping up the end of the fiscal year ending 18. And so we're bringing some fairly large-scale projects to you today, so you'll be hearing about them in a moment. Delighted to introduce Michael Neward, who is a staff specialist, who will be leading us through this presentation here right away.
Michael, why don't you just
Do we
stop?
Need to reset?
No.
All right, hold on. Marcy's up to something. Michael looks unsure.
I'm okay.
Marcy's got something.
If it's okay with the chair, we'll just speak off the slides that are in front of you at your places, and Michael can get started until we get the computer.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Haggerty and members of the Mobile Source Committee.
Good morning, sir.
Today I'll be presenting the projects with a proposed individual grant award over $100,000 for your consideration. During this presentation, I'll start by providing background information on the funding programs. Then I'll discuss the proposed projects with individual awards over $100,000. And finally, I'll conclude with recommendations. For background, the district has participated in the Carl Moyer program since it was created in 1998. The program is a voluntary and aims to reduce emissions primarily from diesel engines. It is jointly administered by the California Air Resources Board and local air districts, provided funding to both public and private entities. The Mobile Source Incentive Fund is the district's funding source authorized by Assembly Bill 923, which allows the district to collect $2 from DMV registration fees. These funds can be used for eligible Carl Moyer program and lower emission school bus program projects. The Community Health Protection Grant Program, authorized by AB 134, appropriated $250 million from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund to reduce mobile source emissions in areas identified as part of the Community Air Protection Program. $50 million in funding was allocated to the Air District for projects funded under the Carl Moyer Program and Proposition 1B Goods Movement Program. Regarding the Transportation Fund for Clean Air, or TFCA, it is authorized by state legislature and set forth in the California Health and Safety Code. TFCA funding is provided by a $4 DMV surcharge on motor vehicles registered within the Bay Area. 60% of the funding is awarded directly by the district. The remaining 40% is forwarded to the 9 counties as part of the County Program Manager Fund. Today's projects from TFCA come from the 60% funding. Next, I'm going to discuss the projects that are funded by these programs. Regarding the Carl Moyer program, In March of last year, the Board of Directors authorized the participation in year 19 of the program and authorized the Executive Officer to execute contracts and amendments with grant awards up to $100,000. That following December, the Board of Directors accepted $50 million in funding for the Community Health Protection Grant Program. For your consideration today are seven Carl Moyer Program projects, which will reduce emissions from three school buses, seven pieces of agricultural equipment, and 59 pieces of off-road equipment, for a proposed total allocation of $8.6 million. These proposed projects will reduce more than 54 tons of criteria pollutants per year. More information about the projects can be found in Attachment 1, Table 1 of the staff report. One project included in the $8.6 million award that I would like to highlight is for the SSA terminals operating at the Port of Oakland. The proposed grant award of just over $5 million in funding will reduce over 45 tons of criteria pollutants per year by replacing diesel engines with hybrid electric engines and 13 rubber-tired gantry cranes. Furthermore, SSA has agreed to not seek additional air district funding, to upgrade these 13 RTGs to zero emissions equipment by December of 2030, if feasible, and to promote the future deployment and feasibility of the hybrid technology. These charts represent the year 19 Carl Moyer program funding allocated as of May 4th, 2018, including the projects under $100,000 and the projects being considered today. The charts show allocations broken down by equipment category and by county. The funding allocated for these projects is about $24.9 million. More detailed information regarding these projects can be found in Attachment 2 of the staff report. The next charts represent about $160 million in total Carl Moyer program funding.
Can I interrupt you real quick? What is in Attachment 2?
It's Attachment 2 of this staff report?
Yeah.
Agenda 3?
Yeah. What are those? Were those funded or not?
Those are, yes.
Yes.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is because I don't have the slides because I have 2-4s, so I'm trying to follow you in the agenda. For some reason, some of the places that we have got 2-4s and didn't get 3s.
Okay.
2-item 4s.
I apologize, Chair. We will take care of that.
I'm trying to follow you in the staff report, so it's a little harder.
Yeah. Okay. So attachment 2 to the staff report are all of the projects that we funded this year, including the ones that are authorized by the executive officer, the ones
all
that
right.
are under
so attachment 2 was funded also.
Correct.
Thank you.
So we're leaving slide 10 to slide 11 now?
I have it, so now thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. For the TFCA program, on April 19, 2017, the board authorized executive officer to execute contracts and amendments for projects with grant awards up to $100,000 and allocated about $29 million in TFCA funding for eligible projects in fiscal year 2018. On August 2, 2017, the board adopted the TFCA regional fund policies and evaluation criteria.
That place over there has two.
For your consideration, there are six TFCA projects that propose an individual grant award greater than $100,000. One project will install 72 dual-port charging stations with solar, and five projects will construct 4.17 miles of bikeways for a combined proposed total allocation of just over $1.1 million. These projects will reduce more than 0.76 tons of criteria pollutants per year, and more information about the projects can be found in Attachment 1, Table 2 of the staff report. Going on to slide 12 or page 12 of your presentation. These charts show the distribution of TFCA funding for eligible projects evaluated since July of last year. Allocations are broken down by equipment category and by county. The total amount of funding on each chart is about $12.15 million. And to clarify, rounding resulted in the chart for distribution by county to equal 99.9%. Additional information about the projects represented in these charts can be found in Attachment 4 of the staff report. In conclusion, or in closing, staff requests the committee recommend the Board of Directors approve Carl Moyer Program and Transportation Fund for Clean Air projects with proposed grant awards over $100,000 as shown in Attachment 1, and authorize the Executive Officer, APCO, to enter into all necessary agreements with applicants for the recommended projects. This concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
All right, are there any questions? So, I'm gonna ask a question, but it's not 100% relevant to this, but it just came to me, and I wanna see if something would qualify. So, I noticed that in this staff report, under the recommendation, we are funding 4.17 miles of bikeways. So when we do the bike, let me try to frame this. So are the bikeways, is it bikeways and trails, or is it just bikeways?
So the definition of bikeways is anything that connects to a transit hub. So the purpose has to be to help reduce single occupancy vehicles. So sure. For that reason, it generally doesn't fund recreational trails, but there are a handful of segments of what might also be used for recreation that doesn't make it ineligible, but it has to actually reduce vehicle traffic.
Okay, so if this trail was connected to a transit hub and required a bridge to cross a creek, mm-hmm. would that be eligible?
We would certainly take a look at it. To maybe say it more clearly, the fact that it might be used by some individuals for recreation doesn't make it disqualified. Yeah, it's just there needs to be a demonstration that it's used for commuting purposes.
And then depending on how many people used it would make it as cost effective.
Right, and then that's how we measure the amount of funding that it would be eligible for.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, colleagues, if there's no other questions, you have an action item in front of you.
I move the item.
Second. Thank you. I have a motion by Mitchoff, second by Canepa. Is there any objection to the motion? The motion will pass without objection. We've had Member Jew, Member Abby Kanokla join us, and Member Kim, I think. Were you here at the roll call, Kim?
Oh,
you were? Okay. So just the two. And now Chair Hudson.
Now, just as a point, Andrew, I'm going to abstain only because I don't know the ruling. United's getting more than 20% of this money, and my wife worked.
Need to actually step down.
Okay.
Would you like us to we'll break out the United part. So the motion, can we just, on this part, we'll vote
Chair,
on,
we have one
we'll
speaker
on,
as
hold,
well.
Hold on, I know how to do this.
Okay, sorry.
So we're going to vote on everything except for United right now. So is there any objection to everything except for United?
No.
Okay, so that motion passes. Now if you would leave the room, Mr. Hudson.
Glad.
All right, if I could now get a motion on the United portion of it.
So.
All right, moved by Mitchoff, second by Canepa. Is there any objection to the motion? Motion passes out. Objection, if we can now bring Mr. Hudson back in. Please note for the record that he left because his wife does work for United. All right, we'll now move to item 4.
Chair, we had one speaker on that agenda item, if you'd like to hear them.
It's not important. It's already passed. No, I'm just kidding. Who was it?
Diane Hines from the Port of Oakland.
If you speak, we'll vote against you. I'm just kidding. You're going to do it anyways, aren't you?
I had no idea it'd be so much fun to be here this morning.
Yeah, we didn't either.
We didn't either.
We didn't either, but some of us have been up very early, so.
No, I came all the way from Oakland. Thank you for voting for this SSA project this morning. I really want to thank the board, and I want to thank your staff, Damian, Karen, Anthony, and Judy. And especially Catherine Mukai and my group who worked very closely with SSA on this item. And we're really hoping this is going to kick off many more emission reduction projects at the Port of Oakland. It's a long road to get to today, and we're very thankful and appreciative.
Well, you're welcome. We'd like to thank the Port of Oakland people that came down a few meetings ago and browbeat our staff. I'm just kidding.
No, he's not.
All right, so move to item 4.
Great. Well, this next item, earlier I mentioned that we were wrapping up the fiscal year with our grant cycle, and so this next item on the Transportation Fund for Clean Air represents the next step for opening the future cycle, the fiscal year ending 2019 cycle for the TFCA. And so to lead us through this item is Ken Mack.
All right. Good morning, Chair Hagerty and members of the Mobile Source Committee. So today I'll be talking about the proposed updates to the Transportation Fund for Clean Air, or TFCA, regional fund policies. Just quickly for background, we've had TFCA since 1991, and we've had policies in place that govern their use since then. Now, every year we do a review of these policies, and we also open them up for public comment. And based on that, we propose updates to improve the TFSA program and to help it run more streamlined, more efficiently. So that is what this item is today. It is proposed updates for the 2019 cycle of the TFSA program. And with that, here's an overview of the presentation. I'll begin with background on the TFSA program and go over the annual timeline. Next, I'll go over the public input we received and our proposed updates to the policies. And finally, I'll end with staff recommendations. So established in 1991, the TFCA is a longstanding primary source of grant funding for projects at the Air District. 60% of the funding is administered directly by the Air District through the Air District-sponsored programs and the regional fund. And today we are looking at policies that govern the regional fund, so they apply to the portion of the program that's highlighted in green here. And as part of the requirements of the fund, the Air District's Board of Directors allocates funding and approves updates to the policies and cost-effectiveness criteria every year. Now, in terms of timeline, earlier this month, the board approved the allocation of funding for the 60% of the fund, as well as the cost-effectiveness criteria for the Air District-sponsored programs. So today, we are looking at the other piece, the regional fund policies and cost-effectiveness criteria, and the remainder of this presentation will focus on that. After these policies and cost-effectiveness criteria are adopted, we intend to open the call for projects for fiscal year ending 2019 in the summer of 2018. And as with previous years, we intend to stagger the opening of our programs. So programs will be opening throughout the year, beginning with the existing shuttle and ride-sharing program. So diving a bit deeper into the process for updating the policies, early every year, we open the policies for public comment, where we gather feedback on what updates or improvements that our interested stakeholders or the general public would like to see. And this year, we opened the public comment for about 2 months, from February 14th to April 9th. And we notified over 2,000 stakeholders via email on this process and also held 3 online webinars to give background on the TFSA program and on the public comment process. In addition, we reached out specifically to the local CMAs and to the project sponsors of the previous existing shuttle and ride-sharing projects for their input. We received 6 sets of comments this year, and they, along with staff responses, are included in Attachment C of the staff report. So based on both staff review of these policies and the public input we received, we're proposing updates to 8 of the policies, and I'm going to go over each of these in more detail in the next few slides, and also these updates are listed within the staff report itself. Also, a redline version of the policies, which shows changes in redline, is included as Attachment B. I'll also note that there, in addition to these 8 updates, there are also various updates for grammar and clarity. They're included in the red line, but I'm not going to go over those in more detail. So with that, I'm going to start with general policies. These are policies that apply to all TFCA projects. And we've made one update this year, and this is a clarification to Policy 11, which requires that existing or that applicants must be in compliance with air quality regulations before they can qualify for TFCA funding. And there have been some confusion on what exactly in compliance means. So we've been working with our legal department to clarify that meaning, and this is what that update is. Moving on to the project specific policies. So starting with Policy 22, this policy allows TFCA to be used to fund on-road truck replacements, and we're updating this to include buses as well as trucks. For Policy 23, this policy allows TFCA to be used to purchase zero and partial zero emission vehicles for fleets, and we're making 3 changes to this policy. The first one is to clarify that zero emission motorcycles and medium duty vehicles are eligible. The second is a change to add a provision to allow TFCA funds to be used additional TFCA funds to be awarded if a project also scraps an older vehicle. And this change aligns this policy with the next one, policy number 24, which I'll go over in the next slide.
Did you want us to hold questions to the end?
No, we'll hold questions to the end if we could.
Right. And finally, the third change we're proposing is to increase the flexibility on how these TFCA funds can be allocated between the vehicle and the infrastructure. The existing policy allows for 50% of the funds to be used to install infrastructure for these vehicles, and this proposed change increases that to 100%. So continuing with the project-specific policies, for policy 24, this one allows TFCA funds to be used to purchase zero and partial zero emission heavy-duty vehicles. And we're proposing the same two changes from the previous policy, and that was to increase the flexibility on how these funds can be allocated between infrastructure and vehicles, again, from 50% to 100%. And the other change is to revise the provision for the scrapping of older vehicles. So previously, last year we came in with a waiver to a project that was asking to be allowed to scrap a different weight class vehicle. And we think we'll see more projects that are in this situation. So we think it makes sense to make this change to policy to allow for that instead of coming in with waivers. On policy 28, which governs the existing shuttle and feeder bus services, we made a clarification that administrative costs should not be included in the total project costs. Moving on to policy 29, this one governs our NEO pilot trip reduction program. And we're making a change to remove the mandatory pre-application workshop from the policy. We think it makes sense to require applicants to attend this pre-application workshop, but we believe a better place for it will be in the application guidance instead of the policy. So this change removes it from the policy and adds it to the application guidance instead. Policy 31 governs the use of TFCA funds for installing e-lockers. And for this one, we're proposing to remove the definition of costs that are eligible for use as matching funds. This has previously caused some confusion with project sponsors. Going on to Project 32, this one allows TFCA funding to be used to construct new bikeways. And we've heard from the public and our stakeholders that there's a high interest in upgrading Class 2 and 3 bikeways to Class 1 and Class 4. So staff has been researching this type of upgrade, and we found that these upgrades could result in quantifiable air quality benefits. So as a result, we're proposing a change to allow for these upgrade projects. So in closing, staff is recommending the committee recommend the board of directors, number one, approve the proposed fiscal year ending 2019 TFCA regional fund policies and evaluation criteria presented in attachment A. And this concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Just real quick, when you talked about the 2,000 stakeholders, I'm assuming of those stakeholders, it was the bike community, you know, the bicycle coalitions, things like that.
It's anyone who's on our mailing list, which is a huge range of stakeholders, including both public, private sector, and nonprofits and individuals.
But the bicycle, I'm just specifically asking, were the bicycle coalitions on?
I would need to go back and look. I mean, they're okay. Well, I imagine that they may be.
Prior to the board meeting, I would ask that you email me and let me know that the bicycle coalitions were involved in discussions relating to the bicycle proposed updates. And then can you give me a little bit more idea as to what you're thinking on the motorcycle? What are we thinking?
So what happened was previously, for the last few years, the TFCA has only provided funding for replacement of vehicles to the public sector. And we had a kind of a very streamlined program that made it very easy for public agencies to come in. And we did see some interest from police departments who wanted to come in for motorcycles. And so what's going to happen is that later this year, we're preparing to open up this program and expand beyond the public sector and make it available to the private sector as well. We don't know if there's going to be a lot of interest, but we want to make sure that we have all of the different vehicle category types covered in order to allow them. And motorcycles actually are one of the dirtier on-road vehicles. And so we think that this is a very good way of providing an excellent air benefit air quality improvement benefit while we administer this sort of program.
So will you be doing that by year? Because some of the newer motorcycles are obviously cleaner. I'm trying to figure out what kind of program.
Yeah, that's something that will be looked at as we develop the program. But just to be very clear, even a brand new motorcycle is significantly cleaner than an old on-road light-duty vehicle, so
significantly dirtier.
So yeah. It's something that while we imagine that folks that have very new motorcycles may not participate in our program for a variety of reasons, it is something that we'll be evaluating, and we will be providing more information back.
Is this along the lines of a buyback program?
Exactly, it's a buyback and replace. So there are we're looking at two different programs. We're looking at a strict scrappage. We're also kind of looking at that for trucks, and then we're also looking for if you want to upgrade to a full electric motorcycle. Our idea would be to provide a plus up for that as well.
So, what guarantee will we have that motorcycle stays within our air district?
It's a similar method to what we use for the carbon wire. There's a requirement that there's reporting requirements generally, and then there's a requirement that the vehicles stay within the jurisdiction. So
my assumption is we'll hear more about that program as you as that gets prepared for rollout.
Exactly. That one and our heavy-duty vehicle program is something that we want to come back and give you more information, because we think that is something that you would like to advertise to your community and the owners of these vehicles as we roll forward.
And before I go to Director Ju, are we doing electric motorcycles for the police department yet?
We have done a couple, I believe.
We've done a handful so far, but it's really a handful. And so we're hoping that by some of the updates that you're seeing in here, that will provide more flexibility and make it easier, especially as these vehicles become more broadly available as we roll forward.
So are you getting some sort of report from the handful of electric motorcycles
right.
as to how they're performing?
Right. So there was a reporting requirement for the vehicles that were purchased, I believe, in the 16 and 17 cycle. So that's something that, I don't have that information right now. But again, it really was only, I think it was like maybe three or four motorcycles, but we had as many as maybe 100 cars that participated in that program. So we
do
have.
What jurisdiction was it?
It was a variety. I believe Alameda County was a significant purchaser of light-duty vehicles, but it was
I'm talking available. About the motorcycles.
Oh.
I think they were in San Mateo, but one thing that is happening that we are watching is both the LAPD and the Highway Patrol are actually testing these bikes, and they are coming out with a comprehensive report. What we've heard anecdotally from some of the police departments is they like the machines because they're quiet. Any police officer who spends 8 hours on a Harley Davidson will come home at night with their teeth chattering in their head. So they like the ride, and they're incredibly fast. One thing we've also heard is that they particularly like them for patrolling parking structures, because if there's anything going on in the parking structure, they can move silently in to address it without the criminals being alerted. So on the concern side, we've heard some concerns about range. Again, mostly anecdotal, but we are watching what the CHP and LAPD are doing relative to their assessment of the technology.
Okay, thank you. And I do know Alameda County is, our fleet is almost completely electric at this point. Director Ju?
Great. Thank you, Chair Hagerty. So thank you, staff, for the presentation. My question is particularly around policy number 23. So thanks for expanding kind of the definitions and the categories of eligible vehicle types. Have we given any thought to restricting the light duty vehicle sector only for full electric? I mean, it seems like that market's a lot more mature, and obviously the medium and heavy duty is still maturing right now, but like, I think we should be driving kind of more change towards those, especially that light duty sector where there are available options, and just addressing the emergency vehicle side, right? Because we still want our police vehicles still eligible for it. I think you can still have language in there that would have a caveat for emergency vehicle types. But I think for the broader public, this drives, you know, all the work we're doing right now on the infrastructure and what we're trying to do in transitioning, and this is kind of the time and the sweet spot where the prices actually are kind of in line with what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and to clarify the way this policy works, so while it does inherently allow partial zero emission, so to be clear, it does not allow any full replacement of combustion, yeah, like full combustion vehicles, right? So it really has to be like plug-in electric vehicles or full electric vehicles or hydrogen or some other zero emission fuel. What happens, though, on a practical matter is as we do the evaluation on a case-by-case basis, if the vehicle isn't full zero emission, it doesn't get as much credit. So the benefit is reduced. And to the extent that it is less and less full zero, then at some point that benefit renders the project ineligible. So it's one of those things where unless you're doing a very large project, you know, involving hundreds of vehicles that are converting over to plug-in and hybrid electric, most projects wouldn't be eligible unless they're 100% zero emission.
Yeah, and the reason why I bring this up is I remember when we were approving projects last year, there were a number of hybrids that were allowed in. And so while I have faith in the calculations and the air quality benefits that are going to be found, like I think actually being a little bit more prescriptive on the types of vehicles that are eligible, especially around specific sectors, can drive kind of who's going to be applying for the grant.
So that's great feedback, and that's something that we can take back for the development of the guidelines and also for future cycles. Right. Thanks.
Director Graham. Graham? No?
Thank you. I have a question about number 11. I'm curious about the process that you might use for those who have pending litigation or unpaid civil penalties. I don't think that if there's I don't think agencies that have unfinished business with us should be eligible for new programs until they have cleaned the previous violations or whatever, cleaned them up.
I'm going to try a real small answer and then maybe hand it over to our counsel, if that's, or maybe I should just go ahead and let our counsel step in.
Your choice. Way.
Well, I was just going to say, so I think what this is trying to do is clarify that if someone is still violating in violation, they're still not eligible. But this really has to do with maybe a notice of violation that was issued years ago, and there are some administrative processes that are being worked out. But we do work very closely with our legal to make sure that we're not giving out grant funding to violators.
Yeah, the basic problem is that for most notices of violation, compliance, in other words, being out of compliance with the standards, is achieved very quickly, often before we even issue the notice. But the process of getting it into the office and getting it resolved can take a number of months or even years. And so we have situations, we have a 3-year statute of limitations, and we try to process things as quickly as we can once they come upstairs. But there are investigatory issues and that sort of thing that happen in the field before they come in. And then there's a back and forth in negotiations. And the problem that we're having is there's a little bit of an ethical issue with saying to somebody, you got to get everything cleaned up before we'll do something else with you if they're already back in compliance. And we're concerned about the optics of that. Of course, we want people to take care of their violations and pay penalties, but we don't have the authority to order somebody to do that. They have to agree to it, or we have to take them to court. And so there's some disconnect in how the system works. As long as somebody's back in physical compliance with the standards and they're not being inappropriate in the negotiation process, we don't feel that it's appropriate to punish them by cutting them off from other programs. I understand that people can disagree with that, but we don't want a situation where people feel they have to unfairly agree to a settlement demand we make in order to participate in a different program that's unrelated to the noncompliance. We've had this discussion internally for a number of years, actually, but that's sort of where we're trying to land with this policy.
One other thing I would add to Brian's remarks is that, you know, if a company is coming in for one of these programs, they're reducing emissions. So were we to delay that If the company's in compliance, who's getting punished are the people who are, you know, subject to those emissions.
How long do you give them to clean them up?
How long do we give them in terms of coming back into compliance?
Yeah.
There's a reinspection after 15 days. It's pretty quick. And most people come back into compliance almost immediately.
Yeah. They're required to come back into compliance as quickly as possible. And as I say, it's often before we even issue the NOV in the field. We get, there's several hundred NOVs a year. A number of them are actually based on self-reports of facilities that are already back in compliance. Other ones that we detect in the field come into compliance within hours or days. So it's not as though we have a list of people who are just lingering and not in compliance. Those people would not be able to participate in the program. But once they've restored themselves to regulatory compliance, then what we're talking about is negotiating a settlement of a potential penalty. And we just feel like that part of the process isn't appropriate to bar people
from the
program.
Maybe you could tighten the language of this up a little bit.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Director Hudson?
Yeah. I had a question, but I want to stay with what Carol just brought up first, because I think we may need to discuss it further. What I heard was that it was discussed and has been discussed for a while now, maybe between staff, maybe that it's an executive board, 5-10 minutes. Because to me, I see the philosophy, if somebody hasn't paid up, and I see the philosophy if you're still pending, but if the litigation or an agreement has been reached and somebody then doesn't pay, I definitely see what Carol's talking about. And so maybe we need to tighten it up for the direction's yeah. sake. My question that besides that, I'll leave that up to where we go afterwards. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just want to address that one point because it's really a critical one. That almost never happens.
Yeah.
It's extraordinarily rare that we reach agreement with somebody and then they fail to pay. That's just almost unheard of. And certainly the type of facilities that do that tend to be a smaller, sort of less, they're not the folks that are participating in most of our grant programs. They tend to be smaller operations that are already marginal. And this is just another expense that they're going to try to kick down the road. And we have been recently, and actually for several years, pursuing abatement proceedings for things like that. But if we get to a resolution and somebody doesn't pay, we will go to court to enforce the agreement. And I think we would be comfortable that those folks don't belong in this program. That's a different type of noncompliance, but it's actually relatively rare. So I just wanted to be sure we weren't creating misunderstandings about the efficacy of the program, the enforcement program.
I'm okay with that. Just to finish up, I think it's something that this kind of needs to be explained to the exec, because I also see that you can agree to give somebody, quote, money while you're waiting to get something closer to resolution. And I just love the term financing is not funding. Yeah, you can get the agreement, but you're not getting the money until we're all in real agreement. My question goes back to what we were talking about with the motorcycles. At the Mobility Summit Chicago, there are ton of new programs, electric bikes, bike share, scooter share. Have we looked at that component?
So anything that is not a highway vehicle is something that would fall, potentially be eligible under the trip reduction policy, which is I can't remember, I think it's 30, anybody remember? Anyway, it's a different policy, which is covered. So there is a provision to allow funding for that kind of activity, but it's not something that would be, you know, swapping out a heavy duty vehicle for a bunch of scooters. So it falls under a different category. And also, I just want to address this issue of Director Groom's request to tighten up the language. One thing we certainly can do is two places we can also do that in the guidance to provide some further clarification there. And we also could certainly provide a provision in the contract so that if we do end up with someone that is in this situation, that to Director Hudson's point, no funds would be paid until this gets cleared up. You know, certainly if they go back into violation, it's something that we could pull the contract. So that's something that I think it's already there, but we can take a look at the language to make sure that it's really clear.
Thank you. Yep.
Let me wrap up my real question. See, what started out was a pilot program for bicycles that we couldn't get a company to, you know, stick around long enough that we could trust them. To, I swear, at Chicago, there were at least 15 different companies. Now, there may not be one that goes on the freeway yet, but there will be. And to me, I can see this as part of a program where people will do this out of business parks. And I'm just saying, let's keep an eye open to that for grants, because that's the kind of incentive program that works. When people test it and they get to rent it a couple times, then they want to buy it. I'm getting more concerned when we do things like our fireplace buyback. You do a first incentive, went in 20 minutes. Second one, people are waiting in line. Well, that's what's going to happen, is they're going to be waiting in line until we do the next program. I think this is something that's coming, and I hope that you can check with San Mateo to see how these things are working on the hills, because I'm hearing bad stories about the buses in Hawaii trying to go over the Pali. They're down to 20 miles an hour or less. Of course, I don't know if bus goes faster than that, but I mean, we need to get information whether or not these things are truly going to work.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Anybody else? Director Kim.
Yeah, Karen, I think that language that says if you're not in good stead with us, you don't get the money, I think that addresses the concern. I did have one question. When someone applies for a grant, do you take into account their history and their track record?
So there is a different policy, which we're not recommending to change. That's an existing policy that does talk about other kinds of compliance. So if you've had an audit failure, for example, failure to report or failure to conduct the project accordingly or misuse of funds, which is very, very rare but has happened, you would be prohibited for, I believe is it 3 or 5? Five years now. So from participating. So there is a different provision. Again, that's not something that's language that will just continue into the fiscal year 19 cycle. So we do have something like that.
Thank you. Can I get a motion? Moved by Knappa, second by Hudson. Is there any objection to the motion? Motion passed without objection. Item 5.
Agenda item 5 this morning is something that we've been promising to come back to you for the last couple of months on. It's the new program that we are devising for electric vehicles in disadvantaged communities. We know that there's a lot of interest on the board relative to this program, so Rainey Chang, our Technology Implementation Officer, will give us a presentation on it this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Damien. And good morning, Director Haggerty and members of the Mobile Source Committee.
Morning.
I am excited to talk about this program. We are still in the process of putting in the components to be able to launch this program later this year as a soft launch and then open it fully next calendar year. But we wanted to come and give you a preview because there's been so much discussion and buzz and mention of the program. We wanted to share what we've been doing. To give a little bit of history, back in November last year, the board approved accepting the funding for this program from the Air Resources Board, and then we were finally able to finish up and sign the agreement in March of this year. Wrong button. So today I'll talk about the motivation of the program, the basic components and eligibility requirements of the program that mainly come from ARB, and then there are some components relating to consumer outreach and support and some of the challenges that we're anticipating where we have some flexibility and we're really, really designing the program to address some of those challenges. And then I'll end by talking about the components that we're putting into place so that we can have a launch later this year. So on the motivation of the program, if we look at where the electric vehicle adoption is today in the Bay Area and our goal by 2050 of getting to 90% of vehicles in the Bay Area being electric by 2050, we have a long way to go. We've made a lot of progress. 13 out of 1,000 registered vehicles right now are electric. We have about 40% of the EVs in California, so that's significant. But if you look at the map of the adoption so far, it's uneven and we need to go a lot farther. So a big component of that is ensuring broad and equitable access to electric vehicles, which is where this program comes in. So we're looking at this program providing a number of benefits for both consumers as well as the region and climate more broadly. So for consumers, we want them to benefit from these new technologies, whether it's fuel savings, the lower maintenance costs, or the improved ride quality. And this is also really aligned with the work that the Air District is doing around AB 617 to work with disadvantaged communities and improve air quality. This is a tool that we can apply in coordination with a lot of the monitoring and community engagement activities. And then looking more broadly, this is a way to expand EV usage across the Bay Area. So we'll have more consumers driving EVs, but that's going to result in that charging network expanding as well. And so it starts to get us addressing the chicken and the egg problem. And then we do want to think about how do we get to scale, how do we scale the EV market beyond the early adopters? And as well, reduce the demand and use of fossil fuels and really do have an impact on climate. So that leads me to the details of the program, but before I do that, I also want to introduce a new staff member of the Technology Implementation Office who joined last month. Tin Lee, who's here, he'll be the staff lead on the program. He's been with the Air District for about 2.5 years as a technician with the Strategic Incentives Division with Karen's team, and was recently promoted to staff specialist and also transferred to the TIO. So now on the program, the idea here is that people who are low income and are in disadvantaged areas can turn in an older vehicle and then in exchange get an incentive for advanced vehicle technology that could be hybrid, plug-in electric, or electric vehicles through purchase or leasing, and these vehicles need to be 8 years or newer, 8 years old or newer. People will also have the option to get funding for alternative transportation through a Clipper card, and we're also looking for ways to expand that for people to access bike sharing, car sharing, or vanpooling, other transportation options. The next few slides walk through the details of the numbers of the program. So we have $5 million in funding over 2 years, and there's up to 15% of that to be used for administration, and the rest of that is for the rebates. We're also benefiting from the experiences in San Joaquin Valley and the South Coast Air Districts who have been running this program over the last few years. Our context and communities are a little bit different, but they've been very generous in sharing their what's worked well and their challenges as well. So for the income eligibility, this is tied to the federal poverty levels. And the federal poverty level isn't a single income amount. It's tied to the number of people in a household. And then there are also, ARB splits the income groups into three levels. One is up to 225% of the federal poverty level, 300, and then 400. So you'll see it's kind of a complicated table that's meant to relate to how many mouths to feed there are. For the geographical eligibility, the applicants need to be in a zip code that contains a disadvantaged community, and that's based on the Cal EnviroScreen numbers. We've included a map in the presentation as well as a printout of the map. Hopefully you'll be able to see that a little bit more clearly. Now for the replacement options and the funding levels, and I think this gets a little bit to the question Director Ju had asked with the previous agenda item on how do we shift to cleaner vehicles. So you'll see that the incentive levels are tiered based on what vehicle or transportation option the consumer would select. So the idea is to give a lot of flexibility and options for the consumer to find the solution that meets their needs, but also there are additional higher levels for battery electric to kind of have a higher incentive for those options. The application process So there are a number of steps to this. We'll need to, after people apply, we need to verify and then support the applicants to select a replacement vehicle, make sure they understand their options, ensure they're protected as well on the financing and how they find a vehicle that fits their needs, scrapping the old vehicle. So it will, because of the requirements and verifications, it does become a more complex application process, but what we're working on now is building out a set of case managers who will be there to be that one-on-one face touch point for all of the applicants to go through the entire process. On the consumer outreach and support, this piece is really critical to us for this program in that we want to make sure that the applicants are accessing the transportation option that fits their needs, that there are a number of confusing things about the vehicles or the financing options, and we want to make sure people are informed and they have an advocate for them as they go through the process. And that they're aware of the program as well. So we will be having workshops and mailers that are targeting low-income residents. That will be in coordination with the Air District staff working on the AB 617 activities. There'll also be education about vehicle technologies. If there are any recalls, we want to stay on top of that, warranties, really making sure to protect the consumers. I mentioned the transaction assistance and having case managers throughout the whole process. And finally, we are working on making sure we have strict guidelines with dealerships that we partner with or financing institutions that we partner with so that the interest rates are all reasonable and the dealers don't increase the price because there's we have this incentive. And also, we want to make sure our systems can continue to protect consumer data as well, because we'll be getting some personally identifiable information. So here's a slide listing through the challenges that we foresee and some of the mitigation strategies that we're working on. So I mentioned the first one about the application requirements and providing support through the process. It might be that in addition to the incentives, there might be financing that's needed. So we are partnering with some of the clean vehicle financing pilots that are happening in the Bay Area and around California to connect them with people who can provide low interest loans. We're also working on developing an application system to support. There are going to be a lot of people involved in the process. So we want to have a streamlined system so, you know, at any time an applicant can know where in the stage of the process they are. So we're working on adapting systems that have already been developed so that we can open up the program more efficiently. Chair Hudson mentioned some of the high interest in some of the Air District programs. We're anticipating that as well for this program. What we are doing now is, this is a pilot program with ARB resources. We're looking for additional resources through ARB down the line so that we can pilot the program and then later find additional funding to support what we anticipate as a pretty high level of interest. The funds for this, the administration of this program are limited, so we're leveraging TFCA funding as well as other funding sources to do some of the outreach. The availability of charging infrastructure, that's always a challenge, that if we're coming in with electric vehicle incentives but there isn't charging infrastructure available, it might make it difficult for people to switch. So we are coordinating this program with the Air District's Charge program, with PG&E, with Electrify America, where we can coordinate the outreach so that we're trying to put out infrastructure and vehicles in the same locations. So finally, the components that we're working on setting up before we open up the program, the application and website, we are setting up relationships with case managers, as well as partnerships with dealers, scrappers, with the things, groups like the Clipper Card or community development banks. And then we're also planning out the engagement with stakeholders and disadvantaged communities. So We are really excited to be able to expand this program into the Bay Area and are really looking forward to both your input and also your help to get the word out. Thank you.
Yes, very exciting program. I'm happy to see the advancement that you're in that you're making right now. My biggest concern is the one that you got to at the end, which was the charging stations. And you finally got to it, and that's going to be the key to the success, I think. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, as the program unfolds, we'll start to put a greater emphasis on this. I would suggest that maybe you start working with some of the communities that have the housing bonds. Mm-hmm. For example, Santa Clara has one. Alameda has one. I think San Francisco has one. I know San Francisco has one. I don't know about the others. Am I missing any? And, you know, they're going to be building a lot of affordable housing. And, you know, to work with the community development agencies that are responsible, to work with the nonprofit housing associations that will be building those affordable housing units, to do them right the first time, get the EV charging stations in there the first time, would be the best time to do it. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest that you reach out to those communities, the nonprofit housing, and it might be just easier to reach out to the counties because they're the ones that are going to be giving the money to do the housing and make sure that we do it right the first time, because the charging stations are going to be the key. I mean, they give somebody an EV and then say, you're on your own. Mm-hmm. I had an EV and I was on my own one day, and I won't give you the "Oh Lord, Stuck in Lodi" song for to go
we
through
like
your head
that story.
All,
go ahead.
All day today, you know, but it happens. So,
yeah.
But I do not want to throw water on this. I think that you're doing great work, and I want to thank you. This is something that's very exciting. I do hope that as we move forward, though, that the partnerships. When you say the dealers, I think there are dealers out there that would be very interested in doing something. I know that I have a friend that is very interested in a program, would love to partner with the Air District, and he owns several dealerships throughout the area in several counties, not just Alameda County, but he's down in Santa Clara County. He's in other counties that I can't think of right now, but I know he's in the area. So, and it's not just him. There's other dealers, and we might even want to talk to the manufacturers and say, you know, just Chevrolet and some of the other ones, you know, are you interested in doing this? We want to make something happen. And I'm sure they're not going to say no, because there is tremendous competition between the EV market right now. So having said that, I don't know whose light came on first, but I'll just start with my left and work around. Maybe I'll start to the right this time and work around. So I'll go Director Kim and then Director Canepa, and I'll end up with Hudson somewhere.
Thanks for noticing. I'm out here in Siberia by myself.
It's all right.
I invited him to come sit with me, but
that's all right. We're going to try to get this. Let's go.
Thanks. This is a really thoughtful program. I had a dumb question and then a smart question.
Finish strong.
So just following up on the charging issue, I can see here that there's $2,000 in there for people who lease or purchase an electric vehicle. Mm-hmm. Since we're talking about low-income folks who often live in apartment buildings, that really isn't an option, right? I know there's limits to what you can do. Are the partnerships you're looking at with charging facilities going to potentially give those folks a discount on the electricity they get at public stations?
What we've been thinking about is that when we're doing outreach about both the charging incentives that are available and the electric vehicle incentives, that we would be targeting the same places so that we can, you know, come in and install some accessible charging, you know, through PG&E, Electrify America, or the Air District's program, and then follow that up with, now that...
Turn your light on.
Okay. So the idea is really to come in with the infrastructure first, letting them know we're going to follow with vehicles, so that we let the, you know, address the chicken and egg and say that the chicken is coming So let's put in the egg.
In terms of the price of electricity, many of these applicants, because of the where they are, they qualify for reduction in rate through existing programs through PG&E and through the CCAs.
Yeah, I'm just saying if they go to a public charging station, how do they get that discount?
If there's some kind of discount. Yeah, I think it's a really good suggestion. We'll have to look into how we might be able to utilize the $2,000 in a different way if it isn't for directly installing EVSE.
I think giving $2,000 to people who can have their own garage is a great deal, but it gives short shrift to people who live in apartments.
So
if you can think about what to do with the $2,000 that gives those guys a break, that'd be great. So my smart question is this.
That was also smart. That was a good question and a good input.
So going back to what Director Jew had said, I mean, the amount of incentive you give, offer, drives behavior, right? So why would we give $6,500 to a hybrid that averages 20 miles per gallon? That's like 70% of what we would give a full electric vehicle that has zero emissions. It seemed like if you just looked at emissions, you'd give that hybrid vehicle that gets 20 miles per gallon, which is nothing, $5, and you'd give the electric vehicle $9,500.
Yeah, so the quick answer to this question is that the incentive levels are set at the state level, and we inherit that from the state. So if we look for other funding sources and want to expand this program, we would have more flexibility. I think the other thinking here is that we're looking at not just the incentive level, but also the difference between the vehicle price and the incentive level and what would be left for someone. So that component is factored into it as well. And, you know, if we look at kind of the choices that we're seeing in the program, how many people are going with the hybrid? How many are going with plug-in, battery electric? I think we can iterate on the program and shift the incentive level so that we're offering options to people and also shifting to cleaner vehicles as well, while also maintaining their addressing people's transportation needs.
I would also add that these are the levels that were set for South Coast of San Joaquin Valley, where the air quality problem is significantly different. Any reductions that they can get there in terms of particulate matter, NOx and ozone, that's why ARB has set this, because it's part of their planning down there to change out those fleets. In the Bay Area, we're expecting the situation to be different. Our distances are shorter, so we've seen more battery electric vehicles come into our fleet, whereas in South Coast, the majority of vehicles there have been plug-in hybrids. So it's kind of a one-size-fits-all that doesn't really fit what we're expecting to see. And what we'll be doing is, as we implement it, we'll be coming back and letting you know how the program is going, talking about if it's working well, we might want to consider expanding this to other communities using our own funds.
Anybody else? Director Hudson?
I turned it off. I know you've heard this before, so you're going to hear it again. This slide 8, the map drives me crazy. We pour money into the Monument Corridor in Concord. I'm going to leave the rest of it for Karen if she wants to hit it. But you look to the right of the Bay Area where it says Stockton, and there's that squiggly little line that goes up and down. That's a river.
I think
both sides of that river are under sea level, and one's in Contra Costa, and we don't have any blue in there. And I would bring it up that not only that river, we now have BART going out there, and we can't get Environ Screen to get off there. It's nuts. And Highway 4 has always been a commute corridor, 20 miles into Stockton. I can tell you in the 50s you had traffic lined up there. I can only imagine what it's like now. And Environ Screen just thinks that river keeps the environmental problems out.
I mean, every time we look at this map, we always go to the Air Resources Board. You know, you missed a spot there. They've painted the entire Central Valley blue, principally because of factors that have nothing to do with air
fertilizer.
Quality.
But this is in this really is in the Central Valley.
Pesticide use.
Yeah. Yeah, but Byron's in the Central Valley. I mean, he's got sections. There, this idea that just because you hit a county line, it's got to stop is crazy.
We're in 100% agreement with you, Director.
And as far as very low income,
we put the inventor on our advisory council.
Oh boy, that maybe that is a good idea, but the other, and we have the people that are very low income in a database, and that I.
The way we're looking at this is that right now the funding is from ARB, so we're using their funding incentive table and their map, but once we have this program up and running, it'll be a flexible program that we can grow and adapt. And address low-income communities beyond the what's currently
so
blue.
I don't think we should use CalEnviro Screen at all. I don't care where the money comes from. We should use what the counties say are disadvantaged communities. I'm sorry.
Right about that.
This map, if we're going to rely on this to say these are disadvantaged communities, this map is...
This is a requirement for the $5 million that we're getting from ARB. There's no, trust me, we've made our feelings known about this to them. We've spent about 6 years trying to get into this program. This is what they've given us. We 100% agree with the board on your direction.
Well, it must come with a match, right?
I think
we can put our match where we want.
That's what I think Rainey's saying. We'd like to get this up and running on the state's dime, and once we have it in place, then we can use our own funding to expand it to the communities that this board think need to be in this program. Okay. That always has been our intention. It's nice that the state has finally joined us. With the money that we need to do this. So that is definitely our intent, and you will probably see us, once the program is running smoothly, come back to you to talk about TFCA and other funds to put into this program.
Okay, so there's nobody else to
Chair,
speak?
I actually had a question off of that.
Director Jew. Sorry, I didn't see your light on.
Oh, no, I turned it on after you talk.
Okay.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm really excited about this program coming to the Bay Area. Has there been any thought of, like, as you're developing a program, what your benchmarks of success would be? I mean, it's kind of tricky because you're doing this for the first time, you're iterating on it, but, like, what would those benchmarks be, even based on what previous experience has been?
That's a question that we're definitely thinking a lot about, especially because this is opening up a new program. We're not going to get everything right the first time, so we definitely want to evaluate things like, how satisfied are the customers with the option that they're going with? I think that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two is, what is the distribution of choice that consumers are making, and how do we want to maybe adjust the incentive levels? I think there's also going to be, you know, evaluation of how we're doing our outreach about the program. Is it effective? Is it targeted in the right ways? Are there... You know, right now, I think there are still a lot of either lack of awareness or misunderstandings about some of these technologies. So I think that's a big component of it as well. We are working on finalizing some other funding through MTC and Caltrans that can support a lot of this ongoing evaluation, and then we can feed that back into the program.
Great. Thank you.
Director Mitchell.
Thank you. Very quick question, if I've missed it, I'm sorry, I apologize. I know when we do the wood-burning stoves, it's first come, first serve. But when Director Jew asked about benchmarks, it made me think, there's X dollars. Can we allocate them at the beginning for the various areas? And then if they're not used, put them... In other words, if everybody called from one location or one region before others got their name in the chute, I don't want to... we've got to come up with a plan of how to fairly distribute this money as opposed to first come, first serve. I understand that, you know, I'm looking, let's just say, in the Pittsburgh area, and that one to the left is Bay Point. If that corridor doesn't call in and whatever, then those dollars can revert to another area. But I really think we have to spread the the availability out around the Bay Area. Thank you.
All right, colleagues, this is Director
Tijan. I just 100% agree with Director Mitchell's point there, because in essence, you're running your pilot program now to figure out what's going to work, and what's going to work in one area is not necessarily going to be the same strategy in others. So figuring out basically what the parameters are for the study and how you're going to be distributing and then how you're going to be targeting your outreach is going to be critical for getting data back to inform how you you expand and roll out further.
We, I think, will have to go back and talk to the Air Resources Board. A lot of these programs come with pre-prescribed. So in the Karen Moyer, we can do things like you've talked about. We can set regional allocations or targets. I can't remember with this one. I'm not certain that they've allowed us to do that, but we will go back and figure that out.
Okay. Colleague, no, there's no item. There's no motion. It's just a report today, so information. So, colleagues, are you done? All right, we're done. Public comment time, which you can speak to anything that's not on today's agenda. Is there anybody wish to speak? Seeing none, any committee member comments?
The executive board meeting that you see, I think, for the 18th of June is canceled. It's in July.
Okay, next time and place for this meeting will be June 28th here at 9:30. Please be on time. We're adjourned.
Going.